Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for your introduction, Siyasotha. And I am delighted to be here, and it is my honor to be invited to speak at Garen's event hosted by the Center for Asian and Asian American Ministries and the International Students Office. Thank you all for organizing this and make it happen. And I am very moved by the center of, the covenant of presence that we recited in the beginning of this session. And this is very important, and it's also heavy to carry, this ongoing crisis in Myanmar. So in my talk, I focus on my critical reflection on the Gitchin ethnic minority liberation movement and a constructive theoretical interpretation of the Lord's Supper or Eucharist or communion. So I like to start with a personal narrative, which I mainly discuss on my social location. So I was born and raised in a very small village named Gitchin Village. Or Kin Village, Mokok Township, and Mandalay Region, and Burma, Myanmar. That region is predominantly controlled by the government, military government. I make the point because it's a very distinction between the rural and the urban divide between these, ethnic or indigenous communities in the U.S. Sorry, in Burma. So, my hometown. Moko is a very well known for its ruby and sapphire mines, and it has been recognized as a valley of hope, as several citizens have become rich or billionaires. Thus, Moko is also called Ruby Land. Unfortunately, changes have taken place, and independent ruby and sapphire minings have been restricted due to the military government controlling the power in Burma. Significantly, after 1988 uprising movement that Dr. William was already pointed out, the historical, political transitions from in Burma. So this change has produced economic and social challenges for those who are living in Mogo. Even though we are living in Mogo and we have our own land, we're not allowed to do ruby mining as our own business. But the rich people, mostly cronies, and some Chinese wealthy people have made a partnership with the military government and belong to many ruby mines, thereby becoming, crony billions. I suggest that this is a byproduct of militarized capitalism, which make the rich become richer and the poor and working class remain poor and overworked. With no benefits. So as a result, my hometown, Mogo, has become an economically disadvantaged place for the villagers, though there are some political changes. So when the wealthy people come and buy our land and do ruby mine industries, the villagers have become workers of ruby mines without fully enjoying the profit of their labor. So they have no option because they no longer belong to their lands. At the same time, the villagers cannot dream or hope to achieve a good quality life as a result of mining gemstones or rubies. So many villages and mountains have turned into mining industrial locations. As a matter of fact, our land and natural resources are exploited by those irresponsible and exploitative ruby mine industries. Furthermore, we villagers have become suffering. From climate change and a shortage of water. So Mokok, my hometown, is an economic and ecological conditions are at risk. So I would like to bring another story, another narrative about Gitchin political struggle. The civil war broke out after Burma-Myanmar gained independence from the British colony in 1948 that Dr. Williams in presentation. So Gitchin armed group, the ethnic minority armed group started fighting against the Burmese military around 1960 and 61. So it's like decades, over 5 decades. So in 1994, the Kachin Armed Group and the Burmese military signed a ceasefire agreement. Unfortunately, that agreement only lasted for 17 years because the civil war resumed in June 2011. So in this presentation, the civil war that I refer to is the civil war that resumed in 2011 until the present. So civil war has caused thousands of people to be killed, arrested, and abused. Due to this political-driven violence, many issues have arisen, such as women being raped and murdered, human trafficking, and other human rights violations, unspeakable. Over 100,000 of Kachin people have run away from their homes in order to survive since June 2011. They're now living in as an internally displaced in IDP. It's called as IDP camps without knowing when they may return home. So Kachin female journalist Esther Toussaint and her colleagues reported a story of young Kachin women in the area controlled by the ethnic arms organization. So I grew up mainly in the area controlled by the government military organization. So this story is a young Kachin woman pseudonymously named Marie Blue. She and her family were forced to run away from her village with her family as a result of the civil war. In searching for a job, Marie Blue, a 17-year-old girl, crossed the border into China and entered Yinjiang. At the restaurants, there she was drugged, kidnapped, trafficked, and captured by a Chinese family in the village of Guchang in Henan Province, China. After 6 years of brutal captivity, Marie Blue escaped from the family, leaving behind her 3-year-old son. A child, she was forced to birth and raise after being repetitively raped and abused. She was later reunited with her family in the northern part of Burma. Kanchong, a local women activist who helped Marie Blue escape, says there are over hundreds of women who have had horrible, brutal experience similar to Marie Blue. So there are so many issues embedded in this story: economic disparity, sexual violence against women's bodies, human trafficking, the international relations between Burma and China, economic politics, of course, civil war and militarized violence. While civil war has not been stopped, the Kachin religious leaders interpret the civil war as a Kachin exodus, appropriating the Hebrew biblical story of Israelite people. Likewise, most of the KIA leader, Kachin Independence Army leaders, have claimed God is participating in their fight and bless their fight so that they will gain victory and sovereignty to rule the Kachin land, which is bestowed by the God as the promised land. So when the KIA leaders and the Kachin religious leaders unite, the symbol of divine victory or God our victory, will come to the Kachin Christian community. So being a minority Christian and ethnic group in Burma, I see the relationship between the Kachin Armed Group and the Kachin religious institution, specifically the Kachin Baptist Convention, that I'm also a member of the minister in that convention, as a very strong. Both groups have believed that the Judeo-Christian God is fighting with them to defeat evil and injustice. So this fight has been justified as a God's fight, you know, the politics of inclusion and exclusion, and who is in and who is out. And the Kachin Armed Group and then the KBC are assumed to be chosen like people of Israel from the Bible, right? You know, it directly appropriation of the biblical narratives. So the narrative has become a battle slogan and a very popular in Kachin Christian community through Kachin Baptist pastors, theologians, and popular cultures. So reflecting on the economic and ecological crisis in my hometown and the story of Marie Blue pushes me harder and deeper about how we imagine and understand liberation movements in Burma. What's the narrative of Kachin exodus or political, you know, liberation from the perspective of these poor women? Why has this story not been mentioned in a church community, particularly in the Kachin Baptist churches? Instead, they just focus on the political liberation journey, claiming God our big victory. Here, I want to make very clear about that I'm not against liberation movements, specifically the Kachin ethnic liberation movement. Far from it. I am more interested in a liberation movement that understands and takes serious the intersection of race, ethnicity, class, gender, sexuality, and religion. Religion in terms of Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism in Burmese context. Here, theologians like Marcella Authors Reed from a Latin American context, and Dolores Williams, womanist theologian in the U.S., and Kwok Pui Lan, and many others have pointed out what has been missed or what has failed in the liberation theology from Latin America, U.S., and Asia. So I critically reflect on a Christian ritual. What sources can we draw from or reconstruct along the way of, you know, while joining this long ongoing political journey? So I find it the Lord's Supper, the communion or Eucharist, that can be a source for Christian community. So drawing on womanist theologian M. Sean Copeland's Eucharistic Solidarity, Asian American feminist ethicist Kunju Christian Christine Pei articulates the theopolitical meanings of the Eucharist, specifically addressing how it is antithetical to militarism. So in her chapter, Faith-Based Popular Resistance to the Naval Base in Gangjeong of Jeju, Transforming Militarized U.S.-Korea Relations from Peace and Justice. So I'm referring to this book, edited by one of the Garrett Theological Faculty, Wonhee Angel. So Pei discusses Jeju narratives, peaceful resistance of to foreign occupation, specifically against the U.S. naval based on Korean government. So according to Pei, the Eucharist, this communion, is not just simply liturgical practice. It is also a Christian active resistance to militarism. Pei argues that militarism is against the order of the communion because Eucharistic theology is grounded on the unity of body and spirit, in which, as the participants are united in Christ, they also recognize how others are united in Christ's bodies as well. So militarism breaks unity by portraying other as a threat and enemies by claiming God exclusively. So the most significant point I want to highlight from Pei's insight is that a constructive theoethical understanding of the communion that invites us to imagine and embody a new world where peace does not have a militarized face. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate all of your presence to engage in this conversation, and I look forward to the follow-up conversation. Thank you.